Hour. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was hope this morning of a breakthrough in the hunt for the D.C. sniper when two men were taken into custody, but the day ended in more frustration. No evidence has been found to link the suspects to the shootings. Tonight on Point, we set our sights on the high-priced, high-stakes, extreme sport that transforms American civilians into high-grade snipers. But first, I'm joined on the line from Alexandria, Virginia, by Matt Young, police reporter for the Northern Virginia Journal. Good evening and welcome, Matt.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, Matt, what's the latest today? There was so much news flying around today, it was hard to keep track of. It began this morning with news that there had been arrests of some kind. Ari Fleischer called them arrests in the White House.
That's right. There was actually substantial developments today. Like you said, police basically took two men into custody this morning who were in a white van at a Richmond gas station.
Mm-hmm.
They were later released, and there's not much to go on there.
They were, it turns out, one Guatemalan and one from where else? In any case, turned over to the Immigration and Naturalization Service for deportation, not to be held as suspects in killings.
Exactly. I think it just seems to basically show that the police are trying their best, but at the same time, perhaps have little information to go on at this point besides certain things, maybe like the tarot cards that they've found and other things such as obscure messages.
Matt, what exactly led to those two men being picked up? Where were they? Why were they pounced on?
They were outside a Richmond gas station, as far as I know, but I'm not exactly sure why exactly. We're here in Fairfax County, and that's basically what I've been focusing on.
Right. Closer to home for you, there was the police chief, Charles Moose, in Montgomery County today.
Sure.
Talking about, or actually soliciting, almost begging somebody to call into the police. What's that about?
Well, it seems to me that the police believe this is probably the sniper that is leaving these messages.
By messages, you mean the tarot card or something else?
No, this is something else. The suspect has possibly left handwritten messages, or excuse me, I'm not sure if they're handwritten, but
mm-hmm.
messages at a number of scenes of crimes. And they've basically told police, given police a phone number, which seems to me is the police phone number, and said that perhaps they would be calling at some point. Now, they called already, evidently, whoever this person was, and police could not exactly understand what that person was saying. So they've asked this particular person to call back.
So, and they think that this may be the sniper himself? Or herself?
As far as I gather, that's what the reports have been.
So Police Chief Charles Moose said today, the person you called could not hear everything that you said. The audio was unclear, and we want to get it right.
Correct.
Effectively, they're saying, please call again. We want to establish a line of communication.
Exactly. And I think the interesting thing is that, you know, As citizens, we get our hopes up when white vans are pulled over. We think, well, maybe this is, you know, they finally caught the sniper. But obviously, they haven't. They don't have a suspect in custody because they're beckoning whomever it is. Police think that this is a sniper to actually call them. So, you know, the person is probably not in custody yet.
But it sounds like at least the potential for a bridge or a way to reach out to the killer. I wonder why they would think this might be the killer rather than just some kind of fake.
I don't know, but I know the Richmond paper down in Richmond reported that there was actually a tarot card that was left at another scene of a crime, and I know that it's been widely reported that a tarot card has been left at one scene. So it seems to me that the killer is indeed trying to contact police in a number of ways.
The NBC reported that the communication from whoever it was very lengthy and contained detailed threats. That doesn't exactly sound like an invitation to a nice conversation.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that, but I do know that police did say that on the tarot card there was an inscribed message that said, "Dear police, dear Mr. Policeman, I am God." Yeah. So certainly the sniper is contacting in mysterious ways.
And Matt, in your area there, can you see the stepped up level of law enforcement presence? Do you see more federal and even military presence than before?
Well, that's interesting. Certainly the night that I went out to cover the Home Depot shooting, I drove into work, could barely get here because of all the unmarked and marked vehicles out on the roads. There was definitely an increased police presence that night. Traffic was barely moving. Since then, I really haven't had a problem getting around today. I drive a red Camaro, actually, so nothing like a white van, but I guess, you know, as soon as something happens, police swarm all over the area.
Sounds like it. Matt Young, thank you for joining us tonight.
Sure. Thank you.
Matt Young is police reporter for the Northern Virginia Journal in Alexandria, Virginia. Everyone wants to unmask the sniper, the serial shooter with the two deadly aim and apparently random targets wreaking terror in suburban Washington. The imagination paints pictures of the killer as varied as the victims, a brooding loner, a foreign terrorist, a criminal kid. No one knows for sure, but there is an American backdrop to the mayhem in Maryland and Virginia, a sniper culture that both disdains this killer and may offer clues to his inspiration. Sniper websites offer courses and equipment and chat rooms for shooting like the big guns. One warns that this is, quote, not a how-to site for the deranged criminal bent on murder. That same site's motto, one shot, one kill. Pass the background check, buy a 50-pound, $5,000 rifle, and get thee to a sniper camp. Civilian enrollments at the privately run camps are up. Precision rifles are gun manufacturers' new boom product. Listeners, is the weekend warrior on your street able to bring down a helicopter from a mile away? Does the right to bear arms include the right to bear military-grade ballistics? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by William Graves. He's owner of GPS LLC and a sniper instructor for the HS Precision Sniper Program in Phoenix, Arizona. Good evening and welcome, William Graves.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Mr. Graves, you say, you've told us that by your lights, by your standards, this killer in the Washington area is no sniper. Why do you say that? Why not?
Well, the term sniper, we like to use the term sniper for someone that actually does that for a living, not necessarily somebody that goes out and commits crimes, or even someone that's just completed a basic four-day class like we offer. We offer an exposure to the marksmanship skills that these type of individuals need. There is a lot more to it, more than most people know.
Well, give us a sense, first of all, of your appraisal of the marksman of whatever caliber you would describe him in the Washington area. And then I'm going to ask you how that would compare with a real sniper. But first, you are a skilled marksman, or I guess even a sniper class marksman yourself. How do you assess the skill, the technique of what we're seeing on such deadly exhibition in Washington area?
Well, so far, and I don't mean this in a challenging way, of course, to this person, but but so far, of the number of people, I believe it's up to 12 now, 9 have been killed, 3 have been wounded. Mm-hmm. One person was actually missed through the window, from what I understand, at a Michaels. You can play percentages, and I agree with the other experts on television. This person probably doesn't have the highest level of training, because a lot of the problems that caused him not to kill those other folks would have been avoided by a trained sniper, for example, a military or police officer.
Now, what do you mean by a lot of the problems that got in the way of a kill in those other efforts?
For example, a police officer, one of the hardest things to teach somebody is not necessarily when to shoot and how to shoot, but when not to shoot. For example, through the front window of a store, the bullet can be deflected in the effort to save someone's life. As a policeman would do, if that bullet deflects, not only are they not stopping a threat to human life, but they're actually putting other people in danger. And so they would know not to shoot in that circumstance.
And what about the weapon or potential weapons that this killer is using? How do they compare with what, in your view, a real sniper would use?
Well, the military and police have learned through instances like this Michaels with the miss that they actually need a heavier bullet. And it'd be much like shooting a heavier animal if you went to Africa versus a smaller game animal here. For a heavier object, you need a heavier bullet.
What's being used in the Washington area case?
According to the news, from what I understand, is a .223 caliber, which is a varmint caliber designed for the military, again, to wound folks. A police sniper or military counter-terrorist type of sniper like we train doesn't have that luxury to wound folks. They need to stop that threat to the citizens.
So talk about the training that you do so we can get a sense of how it's different from what's on display in Washington. What kind of goals, what kind of standards do you set for your students at your marksmanship, your sniper school in Arizona?
Well, we have two sets of programs. One's a four-day basic program. Another's an 11-day that's open only to the special operations or police.
Mm-hmm.
At the four-day, we go over the basic marksmanship that somebody would need in this type of work, in this particular job as a sniper.
Mm-hmm.
The four-day marksmanship, by the end of the first day, most of the guns that the students show up with are capable of shooting what's referred to as 1 minute of angle or 1 inch per every 100 yards.
You've got to explain that to me, I guess.
Okay. 1 inch per every 100 yards. In other words, the gun is capable of shooting within an inch at 100 yards, inch at 200, three at 300.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually do sight in their guns out to 300. And most of the students, by the end of 1 day of good instruction, are able to shoot usually three all the way down to two or maybe a little bit less. And that's at 300 yards. I mean, quite a distance.
So at 300 yards, they could hit a target of what size?
At least 3 inches, maybe as small as 2 inches.
That's very precise indeed. I guess that's why it's called precision shooting.
That's correct.
And what sort of rifle is used to achieve that kind of shot?
Well, the police and the military have learned they actually started in the 60s, 70s taking just good solid hunting rifles with good heavy barrels and using fiberglass or Kevlar stocks versus wood, because wood swells, and just applying good basic principles. The military actually got away from using bigger, heavier, semi-automatic that can shoot 20 rounds and this type of thing, back to a good old-fashioned bolt-action rifle like many people have been using for hunting for 100 years.
But we understand that there are some really highly specialized weapons on the market now.
Well, the highly specialized weapons, that comes with a price tag. A lot of that price tag is actually the labor to guarantee consistency from shot to shot. And that's where the high-speed portion of it comes from. It's because some particular gunsmith or manufacturer took the time to guarantee the consistency of the gun. And most of this is learned from competitive shooting.
And what kind of range would these truly high-precision rifles have?
We shoot, on certain courses, we'll shoot 1,000 yards. And we have a double PhD from MIT, who happens to be our best shooter, can outshoot me on the marksmanship side. He can shoot 5-inch groups at 1,000 yards.
5-inch groups. I mean, 1,000 yards away, and something like 5 inches by 5 inches he can hit?
Yes, sir.
That's quite a shot. Jack Beatty, join us here. We're going to talk more about this training and how it goes on, but clearly between what's going on in Washington and what we understand is the growing popularity of this kind of course, well, it's news to me anyway.
Yeah, it was news to me, too, and thanks to one of our enterprising producers, I spent a couple of hours looking at websites, and it's there's a whole other world out there. There are sniper magazines, sniper books, sniper videos, video games, schools, websites. There are sniper publications that slaver over the gory details of what these guns do when they hit. It turns out that, for $135, you can buy a ghillie suit, which will make you look like, I don't know, a thing from the swamp in drag. It turns out that David Koresh had some sniper rifles down there at in Texas, killed 4 ATF men with them. It turns out that Al-Qaeda purchased 25 of these about a decade ago. And they are, as they were used in the Gulf War to destroy Iraqi armored vehicles. And it turns out that they are, quote, according to one anti-gun group, easily accessible to terrorists, criminals, and the mentally ill. This romance with the gun, the American male, has really gone on, hasn't it? My wife saw a bumper sticker up here in the New Hampshire Outback. It read, "My wife, yes. My dog, maybe. My gun, never."
My gun never, and yet we know there's a sector of American society, and William Graves is speaking to it, that sees this as recreation, as sport, and is really into it. We're talking about the American sniper culture, if you'd call it that, tonight. Does the right to bear arms mean the right to sniper rifles and training? And do you fear copycat killings off the Washington area killer? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American sniper culture, about the sport and training and maybe spillover of that culture. How do you interpret the appeal of sniper shooting? Is this just another extreme sport or something different? And would you like to learn to be a sniper? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour by William Graves. He's owner and sniper trainer at GPS LLC in Phoenix, Arizona. William Graves, Jack Beatty just went after snipers from what he saw on the websites and came out with a characterization linking them to David Koresh and Al-Qaeda. What's your sense of who's studying this long-distance shooting and what kind of person is doing this and why?
Well, a couple things about that last comment. The statement about the bumper sticker, of course, that was made to be dramatic. Mm-hmm. I'm a relative newlywed, so I'd actually take my wife first for now. But
we're glad to hear that.
Yeah, but those are the type of things that the media has been doing, pulling up these comments. The mm-hmm. news has been starting off conversations with terms one shot, one kill. Well, in fact, this guy isn't doing that. He's doing about a 66%. So that, in mm-hmm. fact, is not one shot, one kill.
So he's falling short of that standard. But paint a picture for us, William Graves, or give us the range of American civilians who you know, who you've instructed. What kind of people are coming to you to learn long-distance shooting?
Again, my best student is a double PhD from MIT. When he left MIT, they hired him immediately as a professor. Mm-hmm. Then he went to the Pentagon for about a year. Then he went to NASA and worked on space shuttles. Our attorney, our corporate attorney, we actually met him through classes. There's a gentleman here that owns a Byrne Foundation in Phoenix. He's a very affluent gentleman.
This is for medical treatment of burn victims.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. He has done that because at this point in his life, he can afford just to dedicate time and money. His business is doing so well that he can do this for a living.
I'm told that you have a group of surgeons that come in once a year to do a sniper shooting?
Yeah, at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. They come in and do the four-day class. They get a little condensed because they fly in from a couple different states. Mm-hmm. And they come in for the challenge. The gentleman that runs the burn unit does all the charity work, runs the foundation to build burn units for free, he just completed a MiG-29 course where he learns how to fly and shoot down other airplanes with a MiG-29, but by no means does he ever intend to, obviously, shoot down other aircraft. I think they accept this more as a challenge.
So there's kind of the romance of the challenge and the adventure associated with it.
Well, I don't know if it's as much adventure as hard work. There's mm-hmm. 9 steps before you finally press that trigger.
Give us a sense of what those are.
Range, estimating the range, mm-hmm. making the correction for bullet drop, making the correction for the altitude, mm-hmm. making correction for barometric pressure, correction for the temperature. The most difficult is the correction for the wind, which constantly changes. You have to read mirage, actually heat rising from the earth. Mm-hmm. There's 9 steps. All of those are mathematical computations where you literally carry a calculator or a slide rule with you. To do those 9 steps, and to be able to accomplish a nice long shot, whether it's competition or hunting or as a police officer, that's the sense of accomplishment these gentlemen want to receive.
And we understand that you're trying to train people so that they can actually pass the FBI sniper test when they come out of your course.
Well, what we actually do is the FBI has a pretty basic test to make sure that their people are capable of doing the job if they need to. And it's a very basic 10-shot course, all from 100 yards, all from laying down. They just put different time limits, 2 shots in 2 minutes, 1 shot in 1 minute, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But what our students do is they use it as a benchmark, something to work towards. And again, that's the marksmanship portion. And I can't stress enough, our 4-day program teaches mm-hmm. the marksmanship, whereas our 11-day program, which is Special Forces and Police, takes them from the range into downtown, into airports, into the places they need to operate. And they, and only them, get to do that portion.
What does a top-of-the-line sniper rifle cost these days, William Graves?
That's a funny question. Top-of-the-line or most expensive are 2 different things.
Okay.
Top-of-the-line, HS Precision, we actually manufacture the rifle from scratch. Every piece is manufactured. It's not customized. That's $2,100. That's about 50% cheaper than the other two of the big three, if you will.
And what kind of range would that rifle have? The 1,000-yard range?
In the typical caliber that police and military use, we can do about 8 to 10 shots out of 10, mm-hmm. at 1,000 yards consistently. That's what this gentleman from MIT happened to be using when he was doing his 5-inch group.
And what's your sense? We read that these are among the most popular rifles in the U.S. today for the small arms industry. That's a real growth sector. Why is that?
Well, they've always been popular. And again, what we're talking about whenever the other gentleman on the phone keeps using the term sniper rifle, a sniper rifle is a hunting rifle with a heavy barrel and a synthetic stock. And it's not actually much more than that. It's a very basic rifle. There's not a lot to it. It won't shoot more than one round every time you pull the trigger. You physically have to reload it. It's just a good, consistent rifle with a heavy barrel, much like a hunter would use.
William Graves, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Elaine Shannon. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. She's law enforcement reporter for Time Magazine and author with Daniel Colson of No Heroes Inside the FBI's Secret Counter Terror Force. Good evening and welcome, Elaine Shannon.
Good evening.
Elaine, thanks for being with us. You've heard William Graves describing some of the kind of training that goes on at his marksmanship or sniper school in Arizona. We read that this has become a very popular pastime, not a cheap one and not a mass pastime, but a popular sport. Is this just an extension of old-fashioned skeet shooting and marksmanship?
Well, I think you'd have to talk to the people who have taken these courses. That certainly there's a lot of here in the Washington area. There are hunt clubs and ranges where people go and do this.
And this distinction is drawn, William Graves has drawn it, we've heard others drawing it, between what civilians learn in these programs and the shooting that we've seen demonstrated such terrible effect in the Washington area by the killer there. Is there such a great difference in your mind, Elaine?
Well, since I'm not a marksman, what's in my mind doesn't really matter. But I don't own guns myself, but just about everybody I know does. I wrote mm-hmm. a book with Danny Colson, who was a SWAT sniper for the FBI before he was asked to start the hostage rescue team. So he knows a lot about weapons, and he mostly tells me what I'm supposed to know. Talking with him and other people who've been on SWAT teams and on military teams, they all say what Mr. Graves is saying, that a truly professionally trained sniper will not use the .223 and certainly won't be using the semi-automatic weapon that we're seeing that was used in these shootings.
And what's your sense of the culture in which this sniper shooting has become so popular? William Graves describes MIT PhDs and doctors and attorneys who study at his training range. What's your sense of the is there a slice of America that's most interested in this, or where's the population?
I don't know. I don't think I'm qualified to tell you that. I think there are people forever who've enjoyed target shooting. There are some pretty lurid websites if you look around mm-hmm. on some of the sites about being a sniper, mm-hmm. and I think that term has taken on a very pejorative term. But as Mr. Graves points out, in the military sense and the police sense, people who have been professional snipers or professional snipers regard what they do as a life saving skill, because as in the hostage rescue team, there was mm-hmm. a time when the sniper had to shoot a guy in the head because he was about to pull the trigger on his own son.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, come in here with us. It's still a kind of remarkable thing, and maybe less remarkable in parts of the country where gun ownership is very popular and hunting is very popular. But sniper shooting, long-distance, super high-precision shooting on a large scale, well, I'm not sure where that takes us exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's not about hunting. I mean, this stuff has, some of these rifles have five times the range of deer rifles. It's about shooting human beings. Now, admittedly, good for Mr. Graves, they teach this to the forces of order and soldiers and so on, fine. What worries me, though, is that the sort of dreadful charisma this stuff gives off, you can feel it on the websites, and you can feel it now on the TV. And I'm just terribly afraid that this is going to leak out. and the subculture of the sniper is going to spread. Bo Deedle, the New York policeman, former police inspector, says that already there's been a sniper on the Long Island Expressway, and I'm terribly afraid that through the vector of fear TV, we're going to get more of these things, and it really frightens me because this action at such a long distance just cuts the ethical distance into nothing. I mean, you know, you go from stabbing someone, we have to look him in the eye, to you could start shooting today and hit the guy tomorrow. You're so far away.
William Graves, how about it? Are you concerned that the allure and awareness of the capacity to shoot with such precision at such range may pull in people who are a threat to society?
First, let me say to Ms. Shannon, that was a good book. I read that as well. And Ms. Shannon was wise enough, if she wasn't qualified, she wouldn't make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
Most police officers and military would be well-versed to learn from civilians. For example, I was a police officer in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
After two or three shootings, I asked myself two questions. One question was, what in the heck am I doing here? And the second was, how do I get out of this bad situation?
Mm-hmm.
I shopped around schools. The best school was a competitive shooter, and that was for a handgun. Right now, the high power champion, the long range champion, the bench rest champion, and the 50 caliber champion in the United States are all civilians because they have the time and resources to spend. And these are just professional shooters. The owner of HS Precision back in the 80s, one day he won the world championship for bench rest shooting and set three world records.
But how many thousand Americans would you feel comfortable having this skill? I mean, does it make you sleep better at night or worse, given what's happening in Washington?
I would bet there's probably hundreds of thousands of Americans with this skill. And with the basic skill to replicate what this criminal is doing back east, there's every single individual that's been in the military, whether it's the Coast Guard, the wash dishes in the Air Force, it doesn't matter. They've all spent 40 hours to learn the basic skill to use a semi-automatic 223 and to be able to stand and hit somebody in the groin or the chest at 100 yards. It's not a difficult skill. The skill's out there. It's whether you're going to use it or misuse it.
Mm-hmm. William Graves, Elaine Shannon, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Greg is on the line. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Yes, I'm a little concerned about the sensationalism of calling precision shooting this sniper subculture. I've been a target shooter since I was about 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now 45 years old.
And what range do you shoot at, Greg?
Well, I shoot NRA high power, which is a course of fire of 20 rounds in four positions, 20 rounds at 200 yards, slow fire, offhand, standing position,
mm-hmm.
20 rounds at 300 yards, kneeling, slow fire. Actually, that's a 200 yards kneeling or mm-hmm. sitting, and then 300 yards rapid fire prone, and 600 yards slow fire prone. At 600 yards, we're shooting a target that has an X ring, the bullseye, if
yes.
you will, 6 inches in diameter. The 10 ring is 12 inches in diameter.
So you're hitting a very small target.
Well, slightly larger than a dinner plate.
But
and
you must
high power shooter mm-hmm. can hit that 10 ring. 90% of the time.
But you don't like the characterization of this as a culture or subculture.
No,
yeah, you must see how people are.
NRA high power competition has been going on. Probably, I don't know the exact history, but I would bet since before World War I. The Civilian Marksmanship Program, which is a segment of the Department of Defense, I believe, holds matches every year.
Does it bother you that these high-powered rifles are getting more and more currency, that many more people are buying them, or that's just the spread of a worthy sport in your mind?
No, it doesn't bother me at all. In fact, the sniper rifle of the Vietnam era was the Winchester 70 Remington Model 700 rifle, which was nothing more than a slightly accurized off-the-shelf, go down to your local hardware store when you could actually go down to your local hardware store and buy a rifle and put a good scope on it. And in the hands of a trained marksman, it was a very effective weapon out to 600-800 yards, which is a fairly typical distance for what they were trying to accomplish.
A typical distance. It may well be, but you can see how it also made suddenly a little scary given what's going on in Washington. Greg, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack Beattie, I think you've got some numbers there about what's been happening with the prevalence of these weapons.
Well, I wish I did. I mean, I was so taken up with the grease paint and the various tactical rifles and the ranges that I didn't get into statistics about the but I read some summaries that said this stuff is growing. And that one of the things that's making it grow is that, you know, the country is kind of, we've got so many guns, you've got to now have a comparative advantage, a kind of frisson with your gun. It's got to be something on top of, you know, it's a mature market in America. And we need, you know, a new product here. And these long-range guns seem to be doing it, and they've developed this, as I say, this whole sort of paraphernalia and industry and so on behind them. And they're out there, and some people think that this kind of gun should be added under the Heavy Weapons Act of the government, which would essentially give it the same treatment that other weapons of war have. But of course, the NRA won't let that happen.
Tug is on the line. Hi, Tug. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Wonderful show. I love your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Maybe I can add a little bit of a sort of first-person amateur insight, but somebody with some experience with this.
Please.
I'm a documentary filmmaker with a company called Powderhouse Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 years ago, the Discovery Channel asked me to do a show about the science of guns. I knew nothing about guns.
Mm-hmm.
So I got my NRA certificate, handguns, and I went down to the U.S. Army Sniping School in Fort Benning, Georgia, where they train the U.S. Army Sniper Unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a several-week course, and they weed out the snipers from those who can't be snipers. And I think it's really interesting to note these things. Number one, being a fine marksman does not make you a sniper.
How so? What do you mean?
Sniping is a particular ability to look through a scope into the face of another human being, be that half a mile away, be that a mile away sometimes, no matter who that person is, and pull the trigger, because that's your order.
Mm-hmm.
And then to, as the killing a sniper in Vietnam told me, is then to control your adrenaline rush so it doesn't spoil your next shot.
Is that what the armed forces look for when they're profiling good snipers?
If I am correct, I believe that the armed forces do a psychological series of test batteries, and they want people literally who test high on the social pathology scale. What does that mean? It's a very clinical term. It means people who can cut off empathy for other people at a certain point.
Who can look down the scope and, as you say, stare into someone's face at a distance and fire.
And do it again and again and again. And if you enter the sniper culture, you'll find these are folks who even say of themselves, during peacetime, nobody likes snipers. They're evil. In wartime, we all need them.
Mm-hmm.
And and you have to develop as a sniper. I think as a sniper, you have to be of a certain mindset. Is that created by a culture or is that innate? I don't know. But I do know that being a fine target shooter does not qualify you to be a sniper. You have to be somebody who can kill other people.
Tug, you've added a lot, and I thank you for your call tonight. Thanks for calling in. We're talking about the American sniper culture. Are we training defenders of the nation or a threat to the nation here? And have you tried precision shooting, sniper shooting? Did it give you a rush? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American sniper culture, the sport and training, and maybe the spillover of that world. What's the political message in training a civilian population of snipers? What does it say that sniper rifles are the hottest item on the shelves of American gun makers? And is this high sport, or are we training Americans to kill each other? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight are William Graves. He's owner and sniper trainer at GPS LLC in Phoenix, Arizona, a former police officer and high marksman himself. And also Elaine Shannon. She's law enforcement reporter with Time Magazine, author most recently of The Spy Next Door, The Extraordinary Secret Life of Robert Philip Hansen, the most damaging FBI agent in U.S. history. Elaine Shannon, What's your sense of the law enforcement community's attitude toward the number of American civilians who are now buying and learning to use precision rifles, sniper rifles? Is this welcome as a potential adjunct somehow, or is this a source of concern, fear?
Oh, well, gosh. Out here in the East Coast, which is where I have the most familiarity, the law enforcement certainly doesn't want people going around being their own posse. Because they feel that they should be enforcing the law and not have civilians shooting guns at bad guys.
And yet we read these guns are flying off the shelves. So posse or not, how do they feel about the surge in sales and I guess capacity?
I think there's a lot of concern about the 50 caliber weapons because they can shoot such a long way and they can be so damaging. I don't hear a lot of heartburn from law enforcement people about regular target shooting and hunting and competition kind of issues, because most of these people grew up learning to shoot themselves and learning from maybe childhood with their father and uncle, somebody like that. I think that in the case that we're looking at here, they would be a lot happier if there were more records centrally located in Maryland, which has a very strong regulation on assault-type weapons, and I use assault-type because they're copies of military weapons. The state police maintains a central registry of these weapons as well as handguns. But in Virginia, the law is just the opposite. There's a law that says that the state police must do background checks but then must destroy the records if the sale is approved and the person isn't a felon or a mental defective or certain other categories. Mm-hmm. So in order to pull the records on everybody who's got a 223 caliber gun in Virginia, the ATF is sending inspectors to all 2,200 gun stores in Virginia to try to see if there's some data there they might be able to use. Of course, the gun could have come from
anywhere.
Anywhere, yeah.
That's a big job. William Graves, what about the screening that you and other sniper marksmanship schools do for the people who come to you seeking that kind of training? Do you screen folks out for a criminal background or other?
Oh, absolutely. We actually screen one of three ways. You have to have military ID. Usually with letterhead, most of the military units, their units actually pay for it as well. Mm-hmm. With the police department, same thing. They have to have their credentials, and again, their department pays for it. With the folks that are doing the marksmanship portion, they have to actually have both an FBI and in Arizona, it's referred to as DPS, state police, if you will, background check both before you can attend.
So you've got a sense of who's a felon, who's been involved in domestic violence, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it goes along with the Lautenberg Act. No domestic violence, either misdemeanor or felony. No felony history anywhere, and a wanted check. And this is to discourage, add to our responsibility, and to discourage a criminal from taking advantage of some just good proper training. Mm-hmm. As far as the word subculture that I've heard throw around, that's a great use of the word. To get that person's viewpoint across. I'm Catholic. I guess that would make me part of a Catholic subculture.
Or so, you think it's got a negative connotation that wraps around these marksmen, in your view?
Yes. And the reason I bring that up is USA Today just interviewed three of my students to find out exactly what you're asking, what kind of folks do this. One gentleman happens to be, again, an affluent business person, and he brought up the point 20 years ago when he pulled up to the red light at an intersection, nobody would look at him because the manufacturer of his transportation. Today, it's very fashionable to have a Harley-Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, he was part of a biker subculture. He was no more a criminal than he is today.
Mm-hmm. So don't paint it too easily. Bill's calling from Crandon, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want to make a couple of quick points. First of all, I'm a guy that likes to shoot tin cans, safely. I've shot black powder for a number of years. I have a black powder cap and ball revolver.
Mm-hmm, the old-fashioned kind.
You betcha. And the thing is, I also like to target shoot. I'm not much of a hunter. I used to partridge hunt. But the thing is this, every time some goofball runs around with a weapon, everybody's up in arms, And with the concealed carry bill of legislation coming through, right away Mr. Doyle jumps up and says, see, this is why we need gun control. and these type of weapons shouldn't be available. And actually, it's like this. I haven't seen too many people try to conceal carry an assault rifle lately. And
there was the Columbine situation where the kids brought them in under their trench coats.
Well, yes, that's very true, but it's also very rare. And the other thing is, of course, that if, say, a guy, God forbid, runs around smacking people in the head with a hammer, like what happened in New York a number of years ago, should we have a ban on hardware? You know what I mean?
So you're saying lay off. It's the person, not the gun. And we know that argument, Bill. Thanks for calling with it. Elaine Shannon, what about it? Is it nervous Nelly to look out at the number of high power sniper rifles being sold, the number of people being trained in America, and say, "Oh, gee, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this."
Actually, if somebody is trained, I feel a little bit less nervous.
Mm-hmm.
If they've had a background check and people know who they are, than somebody who just goes and buys one off the shelf and then practices near my house. I do not have any quarrel with somebody who wants to use guns for competitive purposes. But
50 caliber at 1,000 yards? I mean, I'm sure it's a high challenge, but it's also... I'm reading on the chat room where it says a sniper aficionado saying, "Don't try to run, you'll only die tired."
Yeah, well, there are people who use the lurid version of the phrase, mm-hmm. just like, you know, outlaw is some people in country music, or it's some people who will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean, really? It's a word. Of course, I live in Maryland, and we're all terribly upset about the man who has killed our neighbors and anybody who's mm-hmm. helping him,
mm-hmm.
and nothing is too bad for that person. But the gun he's got is not a sniper weapon. It's just a common weapon.
Yeah.
I don't know how good a shot he is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's good enough.
Well, he's 9 out of 12.
He's good enough. Mm-hmm. And he has outfoxed law enforcement so far, and that's what we need to worry about, is the lack of records, the lack of witnesses. It would probably be helpful if we could had more gun records, but I don't know that they would help in this case because we don't have a gun to trace it to.
I guess we don't. Elaine, with that, we're out of time, but thank you for joining us. Elaine Shannon is law enforcement reporter with Time Magazine, and in Phoenix, Arizona, William Graves, thank you for coming on, giving us some insight into your world there.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, we've just got a few seconds, but there's a kind of a culture divide here at some level, I think.
Yeah, this is America, the land of the gun, and we know that nothing will be done. Nothing was done after Columbine, after JFK, after anything. The NRA will stop ballistic fingerprinting of guns. It won't happen. And we all live with that. And as Ari Fleischer says, values kill people, guns don't.
Well, and there's the sport that's enjoyed, but we've also got nine dead. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Coming up, a look at the hotly contested Senate battle in Texas. This is On Point. One of the most closely watched battles in the war for control of the U.S. Senate right now is taking place in the president's home state of Texas, where Phil Graham is retiring after 18 years in the Senate. The Democrat, former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk, is aiming for the Senate, where he would be the only African-American member. John Cornyn, Texas Attorney General, has led in the polls throughout the campaign, but his lead has slipped to less than 5 percentage points. With a huge disadvantage in funding, Kirk is relying on a series of debates to get his message out to voters. The first of these debates took place this past weekend. Here are excerpts, beginning with a question from former Mayor Ron Kirk.
You said last month that the American troops that would go into battle if we attack Iraq would be disproportionately minority and working class. You later said that you regretted those remarks. Since we know that the military is disproportionately minority and working class, what is it that you regret?
Well, the only regret I expressed, Rachel, was that some veterans, principally because, unfortunately, our opponent had tried to turn that into something other than it wasn't, which is an expression of our concern for the men and women that have to fight our wars. Just last week, the president, in addressing a group of Hispanic veterans, made the same point that I did. General Colin Powell has written in his book about his concern about the growing classism of America's military. None of us want to spend more time talking about class. Our principal concern is that if we go to Iraq, if we ever go to war, we want to make sure that we give every young man and woman who fights that war and puts their life on the line for us a chance to come home. And that's why, in the context of the discussion about whether we go to Iraq, I supported a full, vigorous debate in our Congress that yielded a much better resolution. I also supported efforts on behalf of the president to go to the United Nations and try to build that international support.
Time has expired. Mr. Cornyn, 30 seconds.
Mr. Kirk later apologized for those comments, and I think he should have. We were talking about the role of the United Nations relative to American national security interests. I said America should protect our security interests regardless of what the rest of the world thinks. And he, at the time at least, said that he thought we ought to wait on the United Nations. Unfortunately, he took that debate, a perfectly proper debate, down a low road, mentioning unnecessarily divisive class warfare comments.
Time has expired, sir, so we'll go to another question. In fact, John Williams has a question for John Cornyn.
Mr. Cornyn, President Bush has called for a partial privatization of Social Security. That would allow younger American workers to place a portion of their Social Security payments into a private fund that could be invested into the stock market or bonds or other investments. Given the current state of the stock market, do you support the president on this idea?
Well, I support personal accounts that individuals who are younger can voluntarily choose to invest a portion of their payroll taxes into in the hopes of generating a greater return, so that the promise we made to seniors, which I believe is an irrevocable promise that we keep, so that that promise of security can be there for younger workers in the future should they choose to do so. You know, when it's election season, when some folks like to scare the dickens out of our seniors about Social Security, but the truth is that I will never, ever, ever vote to reduce benefits to current retirees. In fact, I will vote to also include an annual cost of living increase.
Mr. Kirk, 30 seconds.
Well, John, I agree with my opponent in that our seniors are scared, but they're frightened because of what's happened in the markets the last year. In the last year, from January 2001 to today, the stock market has lost $5.7 trillion in value. Had what my opponent recommends been in place, Social Security would have lost another $68 billion. Now, John, I know you're a smart fella. You can't promise the same $1 trillion it would cost to create a private retirement system for younger workers and say
time
that you're
expired,
not going to cut
sir.
Benefits.
We'll now go to Jerome Gray for a question for Mr. Ron Kirk.
Mr. Kirk, you and your opponent are running to replace Senator Phil Graham, who developed quite a reputation for trying to balance the budget. Is balancing the budget still important?
Jerome, as a mayor, I've had the responsibility. I'm the only candidate in this race that's had to live under balanced budget responsibilities. I did that every year that I was mayor of Dallas. I believe our goal for our fiscal policy has to be related to what our long-term outlook is. Balancing our budget, paying down the debt, will get us back on the road of being able to once again meet our needs to fund the war on terrorism, to fund homeland security, to invest in education. And so I think we have to look at the totality of what we want to do, and balancing the budget if part of that, I think, yields great success for us.
Mr. Cornyn, 30 seconds to you.
I believe the best way to get people back to work is to let them to keep more of the money, the hardworking people who are working, keep more of the money so that they can then spend that on a good or service that has to be provided by somebody who's employed to provide it. My position has been clear and consistent on the tax cuts. My opponent cannot say the same. At one point, he called it irresponsible. He called it devastating. And most recently, he's called for what effectively is a tax increase by rolling back the tax cuts next year.
Excerpts from this weekend's Senate race debate in Texas between Democrat former mayor of Dallas Ron Kirk and Texas Attorney General Republican John Cornyn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University,